something remarkable about these curves, because this is a simulation of a bus consisting of 30 oscillators or so at different frequencies, and yet all the curves look remarkably sinusoidal, okay? That means that the qubit and the bus exchange energy as if they were just two coupled oscillators, if the qubit is monitored sufficiently frequently. Namely, at ultra-short times, all the bus oscillators, even if it is an infinite bus, all move in unison, in phase, and therefore there can be a reversible energy exchange between the system and the bus. Not so at Markovian times, where they get out of tune with each other and things start becoming irreversible. So the key to what I'm talking about here is that we are in this extreme non-Markovian regime. Now, there is the question of what has Zeno to do with heating and anti-Zeno with cooling. Well, look at the system, the levels of the system. If the measurements are sufficiently frequent, the time energy uncertainty implies that they are unresolved, and therefore the transition rates up and down are equal regardless of the temperature of the bath that the system is in contact with. And therefore, since at positive temperature most of the population is at the lower level, equal transition rates between the two states means that you will end up having more population in the upper state that you started from. And therefore, this always leads to heating. So this is a bit paradoxical, because the Zeno effect means that the evolution of the state is slowed down. And so it is. The rate of these transitions is much less than what you would normally have. But once a transition occurs, it has the tendency to bring the system to higher temperature. And you see here the curve of the mean excitation of the system, which oscillates at very short time intervals, shorter than the oscillation period of the system. It oscillates and reflects Zeno-like behavior. However, if we choose to perturb the system at longer times, longer than the oscillation period, the levels of the system become well resolved. And then you definitely have a preponderance of transition downwards as compared to upwards. And this can bring about a cooling. This regime, which is still well within the non-Markovian regime, is what we call the anti-Zeno regime. It's a regime of accelerated transition rates between the levels, which are predominantly unidirectional from the upper to the lower state, as you would expect. And that can bring about cooling. This is the blue curve, which you see here. And you know the cooling compared to the initial excitation. So depending on the time interval that you choose, you can have either the Zeno or the anti-Zeno effect. And if you keep repeating these disturbances, whether these are measurements or phase shifts, phase flips of the system, you end up converging to a new temperature, which primarily depends on the rate at which you perform these disturbances. Here, we chose the rate or the time interval to be longer than the oscillation period of the qubit, and therefore you converge to a fixed point which is at a much lower temperature than your initial one. But if you were to start from, if you were to perform these disturbances at time intervals that are less than the oscillation period, you would have the opposite trend of progressively heating up the system up to infinite temperature, which for a qubit means equal populations of the two states. Now, this is all theory, but we have actually done the experiment. This was published in PRL last year with the kind help of our NMR people. We considered a system which is a carbon atom coupled to a bus consisting of three protons, okay? And so this is a spin bath. One has to do the calculations differently, but the outcome is essentially the same. If you now perturb the carbon you dephase it essentially by noise at time intervals which are sufficiently short, you observe Zeno-like heating, decrease of the polarization of the carbon and of the protons as well. If you, by contrast, do it at a slower rate, you have the opposite effect of cooling, which is associated with the anti-Zeno effect, and you observe the very good correspondence between theory and experiment here. So these are the building blocks that I will now use to show that one can actually build quantum heat machines based on these effects, these violations of detailed balance and all the familiar notions of thermodynamics. So here is a pretty simple quantum heat machine. I'm not sure it's really a competition between me and Sandu whose machine is simpler, but this I think is fairly simple. It is a qubit which is in contact with a single bath. So it's not a Carnot cycle as compared to what you heard yesterday, just a single bath and permanent contact between the qubit and the bath. And at a certain time, you measure the energy of the qubit, which can have two outcomes, one of two outcomes, but you, again, don't record the outcome, neither do you care. And simultaneously with that, there is a piston acting on the qubit, namely a field, an electromagnetic field, or a mechanical oscillator, which drives the qubit, changes the energy distance of the levels. And so this modulation is applied by the piston is cyclic, and at the end of the cycle you may examine whether network has been done on the system by the piston or vice versa. Okay, so again, the modulation of the energy levels is cyclic. And then you perform the analysis as you were taught by textbooks. Namely, you calculate the mean value of the time derivative of the system Hamiltonian over this cycle. You can express it as the system polarization or population inversion as a function of its energy or frequency, and you take care to close the cycle. So you perform a cyclic modulation that brings it back to its initial state. And then you see that under the right conditions, there is net area here, okay, and traversing it in the counterclockwise sense is by convention negative area, which means that the system has done work during the cycle. It has done work on the piston. And this is definitely, by this analysis, a flat violation of the second law, because there is no source of work other than the bath to which we're coupled, the single bath. And yet, there is definitely network performed here. But there is something strange here. How much time do I have, by the way? 10 minutes. If we repeat this cycle, okay, which means we change nothing in the system, we see that the second time around, we are unable to close the cycle. So if we just examine the degrees of freedom of the system, we definitely see that the analysis is inadequate. Something else has to be included here. And therefore, one has to examine all the ingredients of this setup. And here they are. This is the cycle. This is the bath system correlation energy that I discussed before, which jumps from a negative value to zero once we perform the measurement on the system, okay? And this is the energy investment which will feed this entire process, okay? After this time, this green curve oscillates at negative values, but it ends up still with a net change of the initial correlation energy. Now, when you examine where this energy goes to, the energy that you invested, you see that in this particular case, 5/6 of it went to the bath in the form of heat, and 1/6 went to the piston. Okay? So network was performed by the system on the piston, and this is the system energy. By definition, it is cyclic, so it hasn't changed during the cycle, and the surprising fact is that there is net work performed by the system on the piston. But at least now we can identify where this work comes from. It comes from this energy investment done by the measurement in the correlation energy of the bath. So you may say that the bath shelves the energy, then gives it back to the piston at the right time. Now, this is a strictly non-Markovian effect, as you can see by plotting the amount of work which is extracted as a function of the duration of the cycle. Here, you see that for cycles that are much shorter than the memory or correlation time of the bath, this work is negative, meaning that the system does work on the piston, whereas for longer time durations, it is predominantly positive, although occasionally you may still find a bit of work done, and definitely by the system, and definitely at sufficiently long times, this will vanish. All right. So only at very short times we can ensure that network is done by the system. All right. You can formally prove that the second law is observed once you include all the ingredients in your analysis, which means the system, the detector, the bath, the piston, everything. You then see that there is no network which is becoming available for nothing. Okay. All right. I won't dwell on that, but what is more important is that the second law can be now reformulated or in the following fashion. We cannot really compare it to Carnot because we don't have a Carnot cycle, but we can introduce a measure of reversibility. We can compare the fraction of the invested energy by the measurement versus the work which becomes available as a result. And we see that it is bounded by the system bath correlation energy, which has to be decoupled in order to achieve this, a minus a T, the temperature times the entropy difference as a result of the measurement that has been performed. And this is always less than unity, although there can be interesting cases where this is not necessarily true. What is equally interesting is to compare this process to what we know about Maxwell's demon. Maxwell's demon, as opposed to us, does record the result of the measurement and acts accordingly. So he performs a selective measurement. And the work which he can extract as a result is equal to the work which is available from our non-selective measurement, okay, which I stress is only available at non-Markovian time, plus another piece. And this piece is the temperature times the entropy of the system, yes, following the measurement. Now, this is the same piece, if you like, free energy, which is required for resetting the detector after this process. Because for non-selective measurements, we don't care what the state of the detector is. It can become as mixed as we like. It doesn't affect our outcome because we don't look at it. However, for a selective measurement, if you want to keep repeating this cycle, you have to reset the detector each time. And the amount of energy you need to invest there for this resetting is exactly the entropy times of the system after the measurement times the temperature. There is something which is really mind-boggling here, because when you take the temperature to zero, okay, you still obtain work, okay? So you can extract work from zero temperature bath. Isn't that something? All right, think about it. Okay, a possible experiment that we have in mind is a cantilever which would act as a piston that is coupled to an envy center that would be our qubit in a diamond, and there is a bath coupled to it, and by applying noise which affects the measurements at the right rate, we should be able to extract work which really is energy stored in the correlations of the bath and the system and transfer it to the piston. This looks like a doable experiment. We are talking to a group in Stuttgart about doing that. How much time? 7 minutes. All right. So let me say something now about the third law. All right. So I've covered so far the first and second law. The third law is about refrigeration. Don't look at the math. It's messy. But what we would like to see is whether we can use such non-Markovian processes to cool down a bath. And by a bath, I mean a real bath, okay? Not a qubit, but, you know, a big bath. So the setup is almost the same as before, except that now we have a cold bath that we would like to cool down even further, and a hot bath that we would like to dump the heat into. And we still have one qubit. We choose the spectra of the baths such that their peaks are in between or on either side of the resonance of the qubit. Okay, so here is the resonance of the qubit, here is the cold bath, here is the hot bath. You see that they have finite spectral width, namely they are non-Markovian. In fact, it is only important for the cold bath to have finite spectral width. The hot bath can be your world, okay, so it can be flat. This is enough. And now, once you leave them to themselves, definitely heat will flow from the hot bath to via the qubit to the cold bath, okay, through their coupling. So that's not a big surprise. But now, let us start perturbing the qubit at the right rate, all right? Result of that would be that the qubit resonance would be shifted to both sides of the original resonance. It would be with equal probability downshifted and upshifted. That's if you perform, say, pi flips of the qubit, okay? And the amount of the shift is pi over tau, the interval between the perturbations that you apply, okay? So you see now two green lines, one downshifted, one upshifted. And that means that now the qubit is talking to the cold bath at this downshifted frequency and to the hot bath at an upshifted frequency. That already leads to a violation of the detailed balance that existed before. And now you can have the following situation. You can have the Boltzmann factor of the cold bath, because it is at a downshifted frequency, you can have it larger than the Boltzmann factor of the hot bath, because that is at an upshifted frequency. If you like, you are coupled in the cold bath to a mode which is more populated because it has a lower frequency or a lower energy than the corresponding mode in the hot bath, because that is at a higher frequency. Okay, so you get effective inversion even though the baths are still the same. And now, if you plot the heat flow as a function of the time interval of these disturbances, you see that at sufficiently short times, which are strictly non-Markovian, are comparable to the inverse width of this spectrum, you lose heat from the cold bath, this is this curve, and you gain heat in the hot bath, opposite to what you might expect. But as the time intervals become longer, the trend reverses and becomes normal. So the cold bath starts heating up again, and the hot bath starts cooling down again. So this is really the message, and you can do it with spins. How is this related to the third law? In the following way, the condition for cooling of the cold bath to occur is that the Boltzmann factor at the downshifted frequency has to exceed the corresponding one at the in the hot bath in the upshifted frequency. As long as that is the case, heat will flow from the cold bath to the hot bath. If the heat capacity of the bath is finite, this will stop at some point, okay? The two will equalize, yes? So you will obtain a new point of equilibrium. However, you can then increase the rate of your disturbances and shift your qubit even further, make this delta even larger, so that you talk to lower frequency modes in the cold bath. And again, you will have this heat pumping condition. All right? So you can gradually approach zero temperature in this fashion, but there is a limit, because this frequency can never be zero. At zero frequency, there is no population in the bath, in any case. So that proves that the ultimate temperature that you can achieve for the cold bath must be larger than zero, or there is no way to approach absolute zero by such a process, which vindicates the third law. All right, so this is what I've tried to show. Frequent measurements, and for that matter, any disturbances at non-Markovian time intervals can affect either anti-Zeno cooling or Zeno heating of open quantum systems. That's quite general. And they can allow for work extraction from a single bath at the expense of the energy that you invest by these measurements. All this is possible because at such timescales, you have oscillations or reversibility between the system and the bath, and therefore the usual premises of thermodynamics fail. But I would like to leave you with this thought about what Lord Kelvin, that formulated the second law, might have perhaps said today had he known about non-Markovian timescales and the like. As opposed to what he says, it is possible for a system to draw work in a closed cycle from a single thermal bath, provided that the system undergoes a brief disturbance of its thermal equilibrium, for example via a measurement, something which is classically not affecting anything, but quantum mechanically it does. And the system is brought back to its initial state within a time that is shorter than the memory time of the bath. All right, the bath can then serve to partially store and retrieve the energy that is invested in the disturbance. So that would be my proposition for reformulating the second law for the non-Markovian time domain. Thank you very much.